on the way, and it was freezing cold. And all of a sudden, a big dog came, one of these monster dogs that's used to protect, and the dog came and started to lick her foot and directed her to a farm. And the licking of the foot prevented the frostbite on the foot. Anyway, the owner of the farm was a non-Jewish person, and he couldn't believe it that his dog, which was a mean, vicious attack dog, did not rip these two girls to shreds. But they were pure Tamimus Dikah dogs, and just lo yecheretz kelev, I mean souls, and lo yecheretz kelev l'shaynai, the dog, you know, like this week's Pasha, instead of attacking them, helped them. And so he helped them. This woman ended up 27 different hiding places during the war. Anyway, she was sent to a convent. She was a little older. The girl, the sister was a little younger, stayed in this house, which was requisitioned by the Nazi SS, and she used to hide during the day and come out at night. Anyway, the younger sister had a siddur with Tehillim that she had taken with her from Tells when they left home. She wrote the entire Tehillim and had it sent to her sister that her sister would be able to recite Tehillim. We're learning Tehillim. Listen to this. She came, the ink ran out. She couldn't get more ink. She wasn't finished writing the Sefer Tehillim. She took her own blood and she finished writing the Sefer Tehillim with her blood. She sent the Sefer to her sister. Her sister recited Tehillim. This Sefer Tehillim today is used every single day by Rav Chaim Kanievsky. Okay, so therefore, they were mice and nefesh for Tehillim. Tehillim has unbelievable powers. We're learning each week unbelievable shiurim about Tehillim, opening up our eyes to what Tehillim really is, because people just say it and don't have the insight. And you see what Mesiris Nefesh, a person did for Tehillim, wrote it with her own blood, and today Rav Chaim says Tehillim every day from that siddur. So tonight, Rav Aryeh Leibowitz, who's graced our presence many times, and he's going to give us a shiur on Perek Yud Zayin and Yud Ches.
Hi, good tovach, everybody. It's a pleasure to be here. Are we okay? Yeah? Okay. Thank you, Eliezer. Yeah? Now, as much as we do try to learn Tehillim and we try to understand Tehillim, I can't believe this shiur is up to Tehillim. It's a 30 years? How long?
21 years.
Unbelievable. As much as we try to understand Tehillim, ultimately we know that our understanding typically falls short a little bit, usually more than a little bit. It's extremely poetic and very difficult language sometimes. And there's a certain comfort in that, because we also know that Tehillim, on the one hand, we try to understand to the best of our ability, but we know that David HaMelech put the words in our mouth when we can't come up with the words. That David HaMelech had this ability to come up with the expressions that are timeless, that help us even if we don't understand everything that he's saying. I always think, whenever I think of Tehillim, I think of my grandmother, Alei HaShalom, who would sit and zug Tehillim all day. Now, she was from a previous dor, a pre-Beis Yaakov generation, where there's no way she understood anything that she was reading, but the sense of religious piety with which she recited Tehillim, I would have to believe that those tefillos were more powerful than any tefillah I've ever been able to muster in my life. But we're all supposed to use our own backgrounds and our own kochos and whatever tools HaKadosh Baruch Hu has given us to be able to maximize our understanding of His Torah. And therefore, we're going to try a little bit to scratch the surface of the meaning of these two prakim of Tehillim, Perek Yud Zayin and Perek Yud Ches. Now, in the past, I was told that typically you read through pasuk by pasuk. Perek Yud Ches is very, very long. So I don't know that we're going to get through all of Perek Yud Ches, but the good news is that if we don't get through all of Perek Yud Ches, that's okay, because you've already done it. Probably about 15 years ago, when you're learning Sefer Shmuel, because this is the only Perek in all of Tanakh that the exact Perek, Kimat, word for word, with only minor nuanced changes, appears in two different places. In Shmuel Beis, and over here in Tehillim, Perek Yud Ches. It's the Shiras David. It's David's song about his life, about all the trials and tribulations that one has through life. And just in case we don't get all the way to the end of Perek Yudches, let me just point out to you one thing that appears at the very end of Perek Yudches before we begin Perek Yud Zayin. The one thing that appears at the very end of Perek Yudches, Pasuk Nun Aleph. It should be a very familiar pasuk. Magdil Yeshuos Malko V'yosa Chesed Limshicho L'David L'Zaro Ad Olam. That HaKadosh Baruch Hu makes great the salvation of his king, the victories and the salvations of his king, and he does Chesed Limshicho to the Anointed One, to David and to his children, Ad Olam, forever. Now that is a pasuk that we say toward the end of benching, and you'll note in your benchers that it will note that there's a one word that changes depending whether you're benching on Shabbos or whether you're benching during the week. That when you're benching during the week, it appears as we have it over here, Magdil Yeshuos Malko, but on Shabbos it's Migdol Yeshuos Malko. So what is the reason for that discrepancy? Why would Shabbos be different than during the week? So the Torah Tamima had a famous suggestion, which is cute, but ultimately not particularly satisfying, where the Torah Tamima in his, I believe he printed this in his autobiography, he wrote a 4-volume autobiography called Mekor Baruch, where he describes his whole life story. A number of years ago, Art Scroll translated the Mekor Baruch and abridged it into a single volume called My Uncle the Netziv, where they took out the stories that he wrote about his uncle, his illustrious uncle, the Netziv, Rav Naftali Tzvi Yehuda Mberlin, who was the Rosh Yeshiva, the founding Rosh Yeshiva of the Volozhiner Yeshiva, not the founding, but it was Rosh Yeshiva, Volozhiner Yeshiva for 50 years, and the book got banned, but whatever, it was a very, very, happened to have been an excellent book. But in the Hebrew version, that autobiography, I believe, the Torah Tamima suggests that the reason that people say Migdol on Shabbos and Magdil during the week is really a typographical error. It was a misprint. What it initially said was in the benchers, it said Magdil Yeshuos Malko, and then it said in parentheses in some of the early printings, Beis Shin Beis Migdol. And Beis Shin Beis meant Bishmuel Beis, that the same pasuk appears in Shmuel Beis, not in Tehillim, but in Shmuel Beis, it's Migdol. Someone else saw that, saw Beis Shin Beis, what's a Bashab? It must be that it's missing a Taf. So they had B'Shabbos, and then in later generations, why only Shabbos? Yantiv too? So B'Shabbos V'Yantiv, maybe Rosh Chodesh also. Shabbos, Yantiv, Rosh Chodesh. You'll see different benches have different things. So that's what he suggests where Migdol came from. There may be other suggestions, though. In the Art School commentary to Tehillim, they quote a Medrash Shachar Tov, that Magdil, the way it appears over here, means it's something that's constantly becoming greater, something that is little by little growing larger. So HaKadosh Baruch Hu makes things greater, makes our Yeshua grow little by little. And that's the way ultimately most good things happen. That there may be certain tipping points, there may be certain points where we're able to achieve where it becomes clear that we're able to achieve greatness, but typically greatness is not achieved in a day. It happens gradually, it happens over time. And we compare it to the sun, for example. If a person was in pitch black darkness, cannot see anything, and then all of a sudden is exposed to the sun in midday, so he can't appreciate the light. The light hurts him, it's too much to be able to take in. Gradually, a person needs to be exposed to a certain amount of light. And that's the idea of Magdil. Migdol is a tower. Migdol is this towering thing. A tower is something that no matter where you are in the city, if there is this one tower that stands above everything else, you know to point to that tower. You know that is the frame of reference for wherever you might find yourself. And maybe that's part of the difference between weekdays and Shabbos. Throughout the week, we're always supposed to be growing. We're always supposed to be advancing. We're always supposed to be on that walk toward Geula. But on Shabbos, Shabbos is supposed to be the day that we look to throughout the week. The Gemara tells us in Masechta Shabbos that when the Holy Amoraim would find something, the Tanoim rather, when they would find something special, they would say, let's put this away for Shabbos, that we'll save something for Shabbos. We count our days. Hayom Yom Rishon l'Shabbos. Hayom Sheni l'Shabbos. That Shabbos serves as that tower throughout the week. How many of us, when we're going through what sometimes seems like a long week, okay, just two more days to Shabbos, this amount of time to Shabbos, that Shabbos has a way of serving as that tower in our lives. So maybe that's an additional element, that Shabbos is Migdol, whereas the week is Magdil. It's this slow process where we gradually move along. And the truth is, what we're describing is really Geula. The Yeshua happens as a slow process. What we're acknowledging is the very real possibility of Geula happening as Ani Rochev Al HaChamor, in the model of not an instantaneous Geula where everything just happens all at once, but maybe where things happen somewhat more gradually. I know Rabbi J.J. Schachter used to like to talk a lot about the idea that for centuries, Jews had in their mind that when Geula comes, we're going to find ourselves in this terrible predicament, and you snap your fingers, and all of a sudden, we're flying on the wings of eagles to a rebuilt Beis HaMikdash that falls from heaven, and everything's immediately going to change. And what we seem to be finding is that's probably not the case. You know, it was a very confusing thing when, let's say, in 1967, 1948, and then again 1967, when we make certain advances in being able to have a government in Eretz Yisrael, and then getting back the old city of Yerushalayim, we didn't know how to handle that. What does that mean? This isn't Geula. Geula is not supposed to look like this. Geula is supposed to be with the Beis HaMikdash, not supposed to be with the mosque at the Arabais. Well, what is this exactly? But what we hope these are steps. We hope that we're taking steps, that we're moving along in that process, and that ultimately, hopefully, we'll be able to see the great light of Geula as we grow accustomed to more spirituality and to more Kedusha. But let's go back to Perek Yud Zayin. Let's start Perek Yud Zayin. Perek Yud Zayin comes on the heels, of course, of Perek Tes Zayin. Perek Tes Zayin was a very confident Perek of Tehillim. David HaMelech was expressing a very close relationship with the Ribbono Shel Olam. Perek Yud Zayin, he withdraws a little bit. Not Chas V'Sholom to withdraw from the Ribbono Shel Olam, but to withdraw from that sense of confidence, that he's not so sure anymore that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is going to take care of everything. Why? As we find in many chapters of Tehillim, actually, David was very nervous about what the sin of Bathsheba did to his relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. He wasn't sure what kind of impact that would have long term. And when a king gets nervous, a king who understands what it means to be a king, he realizes that it's not only going to affect him, that if the sin is going to have an effect, it will have an effect on the nation as well. I always thought that maybe one of the explanations of why it is that when Paro calls Yosef to interpret the dreams, and he tells him these dreams of cows and dreams of wheat and all these different things that clearly relate to food. So Rashi tells us that all the Itztagnine Paro also tried to interpret Paro's dreams, and they said, "Oh, you're going to have seven daughters. You can have this." And he wasn't satisfied with any of them. And then Yosef comes along, and Yosef says, no, it's about food. There's going to be famine. And all of a sudden, Paro is he's so taken by it, and he accepts the interpretation. So the question is often asked. None of the brilliant advisors of Paro could figure out that if it's about cows, that it might have something to do with food, that it might, that's kind of a source of food. Why would they, really, you think you're going to win them over by saying it's about daughters? That when it's about cows, that's going to win them over? That's going to be what resonates in Paro's mind? So I think I once heard from Rabbi Isaac Bernstein's Zichron Levracha, where he suggested, I don't remember if it was his own, where he suggested that maybe the dream interpreters that Paro had and his advisors, of course they tried along the lines of food. That wasn't the problem with their interpretations. They tried all sorts of interpretations. But all of their interpretations had to do with Paro. What's going on in your life? This must be about something personal to you, your family, your life. Yosef was the first one to say, this isn't about you. This is about a nation. This is about a country. Because a king, when he puts his head down on his pillow at night, cannot be thinking about only himself. He has to be thinking about the welfare of the entire country, of everybody. And that, because otherwise you wonder, you know, a guy comes and interprets a dream. So what do you say? Oh, wow, you're a good dream interpreter. You should be king. You should be second in command. You should be the, you know, the second in command of the most powerful nation in the world. Really? For interpreting a dream? Is that the quality that you need? No, but maybe Paro saw something. He saw that here's a person who understands what leadership is. He understands that it affects the entire nation. And that's a premise of leadership, certainly of Jewish leadership, that we have to understand that when a person is in a position of responsibility for masses of people, then things that happen to him and the way he behaves and the way he misbehaves are not only going to affect him, they're going to affect people who have learned from him, people who rely on him. They're going to affect followers. They're going to affect the entire nation. And maybe that's what David is nervous about in Perek Yud Zayin, where he starts worrying about, wait, I sinned with Bathsheba. It's one thing for me to have a sin with Bathsheba, for me to have done something wrong in my own personal relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. How's this going to affect my army? He's got a war to fight. And what happens if things start turning sour for the army because of something that I have done? And he realizes that that's a distinct possibility. And he's nervous that what happens if things start to turn? As soon as Klal Yisrael shows any form of weakness, any sort of weakness, there is no shortage of enemies who are ready to pounce, who are ready to take full advantage of that weakness. And that's part of what David expresses here in Perek Yud Zayin, that he's nervous. What's going to happen when Moab and the Plishtim and Edom, when they all hear about the weakness that Klal Yisrael is showing, the cracks in the armor, all as a result of David's sin? Unfortunately, that seems to be the perpetual state of the Jewish people, that we have enough enemies that whenever there seems to be an opportunity to attack, that opportunity is taken advantage of. Mori V'Rabbi Rav Shechter has often pointed out that when Rav Huttner's plane, when that plane was hijacked, that Rav Huttner was on, there was a discussion about Pidyon Shvuyim. Not that at that time the State Department wasn't going to negotiate with terrorists anyway, but the Talmidim wanted to know if maybe they could raise enough money to do Pidyon Shvuyim. So part of the Shaila, I'm not going to get into the details, but part of the Shaila relates to whether it's a Shas Milchama or a Shas Shalom. That at a Shas Milchama, you don't do Pidyon Shvuyim, because you can't give the enemy supplies and money and during a time of war that they're going to turn around and use it to kill you. You can't do that at a Shas Milchama. And Rav Shechter pointed out that Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky, Zichron Levracha, at the time, said that the Medinas Yisrael is in a perpetual state of Shas Milchama since 1948. Aye, but they haven't been fighting Milchama every single day since. No, it's in between Milchamos. It's breaks in between Milchamos where the enemies are waiting to see when the next opportunity is going to come. But it hasn't been a Shas Shalom since 1948. That was the unfortunate reality of what Klal Yisrael faces throughout history. So let's take a look at Perek Yud Zayin. Let's get started. Tefila leDavid, Shema Hashem Tzedek, Hakshiva Rinasi, Hazina Tfilasi, Below Sifsei Mirma. David says, I'm going to offer an honest tefila. There's no tricks over here, there's no deceit. You know, everything that comes out of my lips, everything that comes out of my mouth, I'm saying with the utmost sincerity. And of course, HaKadosh Baruch Hu knows that, because HaKadosh Baruch Hu is a bochein kleios v'lev. He knows what's going on inside of our hearts. Milfanecha mishpati yetzei einecha techezena meisharim. That David HaMelech right away addresses the elephant in the room. He says, I know I'm coming to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and I'm begging for his mercy, knowing what I've just done with Bathsheba, and knowing that I've arranged to have Uriah killed on the battlefield. So knowing that, David HaMelech says, let my mishpat, let my judgment for what I've done, yetzei, let it go away. Let's not bring that into the cheshbon. Let's hope that we can get past that. Why should we get past that? Why should HaKadosh Baruch Hu ignore one's sins? Look at all the good things that I've done. Look at all the mitzvos and ma'asim tovim. Sometimes, you know, in my many years of teaching in high school, you know, sometimes you have a boy who does one thing so well, has such a chayin and a chush, really, in a certain area, and he's willing to put in work in a certain area that you're willing to overlook other shortcomings. I mean, you have a boy who's, let's say, he just davens so beautifully. So the shortcomings in his learning, maybe, you're willing to, because you see that there's something there that could be built on, and you judge him by that which he does very, very well. And Kodesh Baruch Hu, David is saying, Kodesh Baruch Hu, I know you're aware of everything in my life. I know you're aware of all my strengths and my weaknesses. But maybe let's focus on the strengths. Maybe let's focus on that which I have done well. On the flip side, there's the Gemara Masech HaShabbos. The Gemara Masech HaShabbos tells us a story with Eliyahu HaNavi that there was a man who died at the age of 35. The Gemara says a man who died at a tragically young age, Meis Bechati Yamav, and he left a Tzibrachna Almana. His widow was very, very broken by his Petira, by his early demise, and she took his tefillin, and Hayamachziraso mi Beis Medrash le Beis Medrash. She went to every Beis Medrash, and she challenged the people in the Bate Medrash, and she said, you know, it says in the Torah, Ki hi chayecha v'orech yamecha, that Torah is supposed to be chayim and arichus yamim, ba'ali, shashana harbe, v'kara harbe, v'shimesh talmidei chacham harbe. My husband, who learned Tanakh, and he learned Mishnah, and he learned Gemara, he learned so much. Where is the arichus yamim? And the Gemara tells us very poignantly, v'lo haya adam machziraso davar. No one responded to her, because there's no answer. Anyone who claims to know the answer is just announcing himself as a fool. Because there is no one that knows the answer to that question. Why did someone die at a young age? And Eliyahu HaNavi, it's a Tana Debe Eliyahu. Eliyahu HaNavi says, till she came to me. He's Eliyahu HaNavi. A Navi can give an answer to such a question. So the Gemara says that Eliyahu HaNavi interviewed her about certain behaviors that he had relating to Hilchos Nida, and at the end of the conversation uncovered certain behaviors that were lacking in this individual, and Eliyahu HaNavi quite harshly said, Baruch HaMakom Shehargo Shelo Nasa Panim Latora, that Hashem did right by killing him because he didn't pay attention to the Torah. Now, what does that mean, he didn't pay attention to the Torah? So some of the Rishonim, most of the Rishonim understand it means this man didn't pay attention to the... He learned all this Torah, but then he didn't observe some of the basic laws of the Torah. But some of the Mefarshim understand that, no, it's all talking about HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Baruch HaMakom Shehargo Shelo Nasa Panim LaTorah. Here's this man who learned so much Torah. It would have been so easy for HaKadosh Baruch Hu to say, let's look past the Avera. Let's look at the Torah that he learned. Let's look at all the good things. It's such an easy way to find chayin in the eyes of Hashem when one learns Torah. So, but Eliyahu HaNavi says, here's HaKadosh Baruch Hu acting with great integrity and not letting him get by on his Torah, and actually paying the price for a sin. So David HaMelech is sort of asking for the opposite of that. He's saying, no, be no sepanim la Torah. I want you to judge me based on my meisharim, based on that which I do well, that which I do correctly. Pasuk Gimel, b'chanta libi, pakanta laila, tziraftani, bal timtza zamosi, bal yavar pi. He says, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, you're bochein lev, you're able to examine what's in my heart, and at nighttime I was able to assess my situation, and tziraftani. Tziraftani means that you have purged me, you have given me nisyonos, and bal timtza, and that hasn't been successful, meaning you didn't find what you were looking for. When HaKadosh Baruch Hu gives a nisayon to a person, what HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants is that the person should pass the nisayon. That's ultimately the best outcome. And David HaMelech says, you know, you gave me nisyonos and I failed. Bal Timsa, Zamosi Bal Yavar Pi. And my, you know, the thoughts and the plans that I had never should have come out of my mouth. Meaning what David HaMelech is saying was that I made a big mistake. That the Gemara refers to that David HaMelech is acknowledging that he asked for a Nisayon, that he asked for a test. That David HaMelech was wondering why it is that in Tefillah, the Gemara tells us in Masech Sanhedrin, why it is that in Tefillah we say Elokei Avram, Elokei Yitzchak, Elokei Yaakov. David HaMelech says, you know, I made it to the Yushpizin, why can't I make it to the Bracha in Tefillah? You know, he didn't say the thing about the Yushpizin, but why can't I make it into the Bracha in Tefillah? Why isn't it Elokei David? So Kodesh Baruch Hu says, well, you know, Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, they were all tested. They all passed Nisyonos. So David HaMelech says, okay, let's give it a try. Give it a try. Let's see if I can pass in Nisayon. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave him Nisayon and he didn't pass. And I think that's such a critical lesson that HaKadosh Baruch Hu gives us Nisyonos with the plan that we should be able to pass Nisyonos. And Nisyonos are very important. You know, my friend Rabbi Ephraim Goldberg recently said, you know, people ask, why do bad things happen to good people? Difficult things happen to good people. Bad things don't. We believe ultimately everything is for the good. Nisyonos are difficult. They're challenging. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu gives them to us, and ultimately you will often find that when one goes through a Nisayon, a particularly challenging time, they wouldn't, in retrospect, they wouldn't trade that experience for anything in the world. It's hard to understand. I had about 2 years ago a two-time cancer survivor spoken by Shul, and it was a miracle. He was a walking miracle, absolutely a walking miracle. The Nisyonos that he went through, also not just with himself, with his children, also suffering horrible health issues. And he said, you know, after it's all said and done, I don't wish it upon anybody, but I wouldn't give it away for anything. I wouldn't trade that experience for anything. What it taught me about myself, what it taught me about community, what it taught me about Klal Yisrael, so difficult to understand. But that's what a Nisayon is. That a Nisayon is something that is able to bring out the best in a person when HaKadosh Baruch Hu decides on his terms to give it to a person. Just this Shabbos in our shul, we had the privilege of having Dr. David Palkovitz, and he was describing how on a Chai Lifeline retreat, just a short while ago, if you go to a Chai Lifeline retreat, you should know, again, never know from these things, the one thing that everybody has in common is terrible illness for a child in the family. And the people are from all across the Orthodox spectrum, the Jewish spectrum, really. And you have Hasidim and Litvaks and Sfardim and everybody is, and it doesn't matter, because we know ultimately these silly divisions don't matter, because ultimately people are brought together. And sadly, in this situation, as a result of Tsaros, and he said that there was a Hasidish man who commented that the day after the diagnosis that his child had received, it happened to have been Yom Kippur, and he was in shul davening on Yom Kippur, and all of a sudden he felt a tremendous sense of joy overcome his whole body. He felt like this tremendous sense of comfort and joy. And you know, Dr. Pelkovitz said he was like looking at him sideways a little bit, but everybody else in the circle, everybody else who was experiencing the same thing that he was experiencing, nodded in agreement, as if they had that similar type of experience, where when one goes through a Nisayon, one learns things about themselves and about the Ribbono Shel Olam and about their relationship with the Ribbono Shel Olam, and one discovers, and sometimes Nisyonos are they're always challenging, but sometimes they're very valuable. However, they're supposed to be on HaKadosh Baruch Hu's terms. We daven every day, Al Tivieni Loli De Nisayon. Don't bring me Nisyonos. We don't look for Nisyonos. David HaMelech is saying over here, Zamosi Bal Yavar Pi. It was a mistake. I never should have asked for a Nisayon. It doesn't end well when we look for a Nisayon that HaKadosh Baruch Hu was not otherwise planning on giving to a person. Reminiscent a little bit of what we'll see in the Daf Yomi, for those who do the Daf Yomi, where Eov is given Nisayon after Nisayon. How did that start? Because there was a conversation that happened up in Shemayim, where HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, look, there's no one in the entire world like Avraham, like my Avdi Avraham, my Eved Avraham. He's the best. He's so wonderful. He passed 10 Nisyonos. And the challenge is given. What about Eov? Why not Eov? Well, Eov never had Nisyonos. Well, try it. Let's see. I bet you Eov can pass every Nisayon. And it didn't end particularly well. It didn't go particularly easily, obviously, to put it mildly, for Eov, that he held out pretty strong for a while, but it didn't end so well. Pasuk Dalid, Lefulos Adam Bedvar Sfasecha Anisha Marti Orchos Paritz. The pu'ulos of a person, the actions of a person that go with the words of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So I was careful to watch the orchos parits. Parits means someone who makes a breach. Those who breach the laws of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. David was saying, perhaps, the discussion in the Rishonim over here, what exactly he was saying, either that once I sinned that one time, I started to be much more careful about myself, and I watched my own pirtzos, my own mistakes, my own problems, or I started being more careful about making sure other people don't do averos, making sure other people don't make mistakes. You know, we live in a live and let live kind of world, you know, where the proper attitude that people take where we are in this place and time in history is that, you know, and it's overall, it's beneficial for us that people have this attitude of live and let live. You know, I do my thing, you do your thing. I'm not going to be bothered by what you do. But within Klal Yisrael, it's not really supposed to be that way. We have a mitzvah in the Torah of Alcheach Tochiach Hasamasecha. It should bother us when we see people not doing the right thing. If people do averos, it's not okay. It's not, okay, so that's, you know, we do this, he does that. It's not okay. It's something that should hurt us. It should pain us. Often the best response is not necessarily to get up and shout about it. There are better ways to deal with it, but at least the pain should be there. Dr. Pelkovitz just told the story today also. I will piggyback everything he said. He told the story of how Rosh Shlomo Zalman Auerbach came into Kol Torah one day, and he canceled shir. And he said a Musar Shmuz instead of shir, which was highly unusual. Rosh Shlomo Zalman, as probably most of you are aware, really liked Torah. He didn't like to cancel shir. So he canceled shir. So what happened? He explained. He was in Beit Vegan that Shabbos in a community for an Afruv, and he saw the father of the Chasson schlepping chairs from the Beis Medrash to the catering place to set up. And the Chasson is walking right along with his father. Father's got three chairs under each arm. Chasson is walking right next to him. Nothing in his hands, not offering to help, nothing. Just letting the father, and he goes back, more chairs, Chasson keeps walking right along. And Rosh Shlomo Zalman couldn't believe what he was seeing. He said, Kibarav. And the Chasson says, no, I don't hold from the Erev. It's a Chumrah, I don't hold from the... And he said that the priorities, and Rosh Shlomo Zalman started to weep, he started to cry. To see someone commit an avera like that in terms of his chisaron and kibbutz under the guise of piety, he thought was a very terrible thing. It should bother us. Now, how to deal with it when something happens, when people don't behave? Okay, that's a different story. But at least it should bother us. And David HaMelech says, "I shamarti orchos paritz." Pasuk Hey, Tamoch Ashurei b'maglo secha. He says that my ma'agal is a circle. So he's saying I want my steps to be solid and to be strong. Bal namotu fa'amai. Let my feet shouldn't slip. I should be solid in my ability to take steps in this circle. What kind of circle is it talking about? So in the Art School of Yeri, he quotes from the Malbim that a person should always try to be as straight in life as possible. We know in general, honesty is a good thing, right? We know how to identify the good midos. Humility is a good thing. We know if I gave you a list of midos, you'd easily be able to sort them into good and bad. However, there are certain times, and there are many Musar Svarim that are written based on this premise, there are certain times where the straight path is not necessarily what's called for. There are certain times where a person has to be dishonest. for example, very rare, very rare. Overall, honesty is the right answer. Chosamo shel Kadosh Baruch Hu Emes. Hashem signs his name with Emes. And we're supposed to be like Hashem to the best of our ability. But the Gemara says, for example, Mishanin mipnei Hashalom. If there's a significant issue of peace, where we're changing the truth a little bit will help maintain peace. We learn that from Hashem also. Hashem tells Avraham, you know, Sarah said, Ani zakanti. That's not, I'm too old to have children. That's not what Sarah said. Sarah said, Adoni zakein. Hashem changed it. Hashem lied, so to speak, in order to maintain shalom. There are certain circumstances where we can't go straight, where we need to go a little bit in a circle. Reminiscent of Yaakov Avinu when he says to Rachel that Rachel says, you know, you should know my father. He's going to deceive you at every end. I know my father well. And Yaakov says, Achav ani b'mirma. I will be just as tricky as him. And Rachel's thinking, well, then I'm not sure if I want to marry you. You're just as tricky. I know what that's like. That's not such a great thing. He says, no, when dealing with that kind of person, that's the way you have to be. So that's what the Malbim suggests over here. The Magal that he's talking about, the circular bent route, not the straight path, is what's sometimes necessary in trying circumstances. One has to be very careful, though. One has to be very cautious, because it's very easy, once we veer from the path, to make that the new normal and to make that our acceptable behavior. We have to be very cognizant of that. We have to be very aware of that. That if we're pulling ourselves away from the proper from our normal behavior, that we recognize that is meant to be an aberration, and that our normal, honest, and humble, and all the other good midos that still remains what our default position is throughout the rest of our lives. In fact, the entire Sefer Orchos Tzadikim, my favorite Musar Sfarim, the Orchos Tzadikim is a very organized Sefer. I like Sfarim that are organized. So he has a chapter on each Midah. A chapter on Gaiva, a chapter on Anivus, a chapter on Kas, each Midah he has a chapter on. But the premise of the entire book is that there's no such thing as a good Midah or a bad Midah. There are Midos that are all midos have to be used for the good. They have to be used in the proper way. But there's a time and place for every single midah. Sometimes it's a very limited time and place, but a time and place for every single midah. Pasuk Vav, Ani krasicha kisa anei nikel, hat ozn chali shema imrasi. David HaMelech says, I called out to you. So Hashem, lend me your ear. You know, give me, pay attention to my tefillah. Haflei chasadecha Moshiach chosim mimiskomimim biminecha. Withdraw your kindness. The one who takes care of those who look for saving from those who rise up against you, those who rebel against you. Shamreni ki ishon bas ayin bitzel knafecha tastireni. That you should guard me as the ishon bas ayin. What is the ishon? Ishon, most understand, is the black of the eye. That it's a lashon of the black of the eye. Bitzel knafecha tastireni. And in the shadow of your wings, you should hide me. That's a lashon of protection, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu should protect me. The black part of the eye has a protection, meaning the eye is a very sensitive part of the body. It's a very critical part of the body. It's extremely sensitive. HaKadosh Baruch Hu built in a protection, an eyelid, and eyelashes to help protect the black part of the eye. So David is using that as the imagery. Treat me, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, like you built the human body. We use the human body as a metaphor for how I would like you to treat me. I realize how vulnerable I am, just like we instinctively realize how vulnerable our eyes are. That's why it's so difficult when people first get contact lenses. It's like it's a reflex that when you see something coming at your eye, you immediately shut your eye. It's very difficult to keep your eye, to put in eye drops or to put in contact lenses at first until you get used to it. Because the instinctively, we know that we have a built-in protection for the eye. Ishon might also mean ish plus the letters vav nun. that Ish is a reference to man, and Vav Nun is a suffix that could sometimes mean a way of showing an expanded version of something or a miniature version of something. So it's Ish with the Vav Nun, Ishon. So in what sense is the eye in Ishon? So if you look in someone's eye, you could often see a mini reflection of yourself. So like you see a little mini me. And maybe that's, they point out in the article, the Nimr of Gifter, that's maybe a very helpful thing for a person. There's a lesson there as well. That when you look at someone else, you should see yourself as very small. You know, you should see yourself as not being the center of the conversation, but the someone else as being like you fit right there in his in the black of their eye, that they are the center of the conversation. Sometimes people feel the need to constantly be talking. Now, there's a famous story about the Lubavitcher Rebbe, where someone wrote a letter to the Rebbe describing his terrible tzaros that he's having in his life. Dear Rebbe, I am having terrible tzaros. I can't, my kids aren't, you know, behaving, and I can't get my wife to respect me, and I have no success with my job, and I this, and I that, and I feel like this, and I feel like not leaving, getting out of my house in the morning, and I feel like, just on and on. And the Rebbe wrote him back without writing a single word. The Rebbe just took a pen and circled the word I every time it appeared in the letter. Every sentence had at least one time the word I. And the Rebbe said, there's your problem. That everything is I this, I that. Once you start thinking about other people, once you start getting outside of yourself and minimizing yourself, you're then going to find much more happiness in your own life. A tremendous, tremendous insight. That if a person is, if a person's whole world is oneself, so then a person lives in a very tiny world and one that he'll often find and not worth living in. But if a person realizes that the world is much bigger and that he's just a small cog in this larger world, he's going to look to what he can do to make an impact on this much more important world that's out there. Pasuk tes, mipnei rishayim zu shaduni oivai benefesh yakifu alai, that from the rishayim who have shaduni, who have taken all that I have, oivai benefesh yakifu alai, the enemies who threaten my nefesh have surrounded me. To be makif is the lashon of surrounding. There's an iser in the Torah that you're not allowed to be makif pa'as roshcha, means to make a round haircut. That's a lashon of hekif. Chalbamo sagru pimo dibru begeus. They're so in covered up in their own fat, they speak with such gaiva, with such arrogance. Meaning people who are in self-indulgent become very arrogant. They become, they're so used to luxury, they're so used to treating themselves. You know, it's a culture where you hear slogans in advertisements, you deserve it, do it for you. You know, that's not a healthy attitude for a person to constantly be taking. Of course, a person cannot neglect oneself, but a person has to be thinking of others much more. There's a professor in Wharton named Adam Grant who wrote two best-selling books. One of them was really good, the other one's okay. But the first one was really, really good. It was one of the better Musar Sfarim I've read, even though it wasn't, you know, it's from a secular professor. It's called Give and Take. And it's all about, all research-based, on the value of being a giver in life. And how nice guys don't finish last. In the short run they do, but in the long run they finish first. All research based, very fantastic book. And he develops a term. He says it's not that one is supposed to be selfless. Selfless implies that there's no sense of self. That's not what one is supposed to be. He says, you know, nor should one be selfish, because then one is magnifying the sense of self. He coins a term, otherish. A person should be otherish. That others should be the point of emphasis. But yourself is also, you have to take care of yourself as well, but the point of emphasis should be others. When one is constantly indulging oneself, it just leads to an unhealthy sense of gaiva, and gaiva is the worst. It's the worst midah. Mori Verabi Rav Shechter has a tremendous anivus, and he has a tremendous ability to sniff out gaiva, like to sniff out false modesty, and to know when something's not right with someone, you know, that there's not the proper sense of anivus that a person has. The most of the Musar Sfarim write that the avi avos hatuma of all midos, the worst mida, is gaiva, because it leads to everything else bad. It all starts with gaiva. So people who are David's describing his enemies in that way. Pasuk Yud Aleph, Ashureinu ata sivavunu einayim yoshisu lintos ba'aretz. Now they're all around. They're looking over the land to try to attack. Dimyono ka'arye yichsof litrof v'chachvir yoshev b'mistarin. That he looks like a lion trying to tear something apart, like lurking and hiding b'mistarin, in hiding, waiting to attack. And that's what we spoke about before, that our enemies are often lurking. They're waiting. They're waiting for the opportunity. Dimyono might also be a lashon of someone's own dimyon, meaning someone's own imagination. That very often people think of themselves as a lion, but others don't necessarily see them in that way. That they think of this relates to the gaiva that he was just speaking about before. They think of themselves as so important that they think that they're like a lion, but it's not really, that's not really the truth. So, Kuma Hashem Kadma Fanav Hachrieu Palta Nafshi Merasha Charbecha. So, David HaMelech davens that Hashem should be able to go up against his enemies and bring the enemies to his knees, and in that way save David from these horrible people, if HaKadosh Baruch Hu will rise up on his behalf. Mimsim yalcha Hashem, mimsim mecheled chelkam b'chayim, utzfuncha tamale zitnam, yispu uvanim v'inichu yisram la'olulehem. That David HaMelech is saying, you know, if one has to die, mimsim yalcha Hashem, mimsim mecheled chelkam, mecheled, that I would much prefer to die at your hand, David says, than to die of anything else. I mean, dying from God's own hand is better than dying from the hand of the enemy. And cheled is a lashon of rust, that a person becomes old, that, you know, as the expression goes, when a person says, I feel like I'm getting old, well, it beats the alternative, that a person wants to be getting older. That's a healthy thing, that's a good thing, and it beats the alternative, but you want to die from a Kodesh Baruch Hu's hand rather than from the hand of an enemy. It's considered the ultimate indignity to give our enemies the satisfaction of being able to hurt us, being able to harm us. That's how Shaul HaMelech, when he realized that it was all over, and he realized he had gotten the message the previous day when he had called up the spirit of Shmuel to have a conversation with him. If you recall the story, David Shaul HaMelech tried all sorts of ways to communicate with HaKadosh Baruch Hu, but Nevuah wasn't working, and the Urim V'Tumim would never work for him after he killed out Novir HaKohanim. There was no option. He had nowhere to go. So he went to some crystal ball lady to channel the spirits. And she channels the spirit of Shmuel. And Shmuel is already dead. And Shmuel says, you know, as the old joke goes, you know, I have good news and bad news. There's baseball in heaven, but you're pitching tomorrow. So Shmuel says, you know, you're pitching tomorrow. You're not lasting much longer. Tomorrow is the end for you. So Shaul knew it was the end, but he was fighting a battle with the Plishtim, and he asks his Nosei Kelev. He asks this person who's helping him, do me a favor, kill me, because I don't want to die at the hands of the enemy. Dying at the hands of the enemy is considered to be a very terrible indignity. So David HaMelech is davening that when I go, it should be in the way that I would want that I would want to go. It should not be at the hands of the enemy. Pasuk Tezvav, the last pasuk in Perek Yud Zayin, Ani b'tzedek echzeh panecha espa v'hakitz t'munasecha. With tzedek, I will see your face and esba'a, to be satisfied, b'hakitz t'munasecha, by when I wake up and I see your t'muna and I see your image. The word t'muna always refers to an image of something, a copy of something. Lo sasel chapesel v'chol t'muna, the Isra in the Torah, to make foreign images. What does it mean? You're not allowed to make images of the sun. You can't make the actual sun, but an image of the sun, an image of the constellations. That's always what a tamuna is. The nefesh of a person's neshama, is a tamuna of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. It's not HaKadosh Baruch Hu, but it is a man is created B'Tselem Elokim, that it's the image of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. It's some sort of, I once heard a beautiful drush from Rabbi Isaac Bernstein. He said, L'sas Elokim Pesel V'chol Tamuna, that one should never make himself the image of anybody else. Sometimes we have our heroes and we think that we can be them. So we try to do everything exactly as they do. What is the continuation of the pasuk? Asher b'shamayim mima'al v'asher ba'aretz mitachas. So in the correct pshat in the pasuk obviously is, don't make a tamuna of anything, not of anything that's in shamayim or any idols down here that's an image of anything down here. But al derech drush, he suggested, don't try to be somebody that you're not. Don't make yourself, don't make yourself a tamuna, an exact image, a replica of somebody else. Rather, what should you do? Asher b'shamayim. When it comes to issues of shamayim, when it comes to heavenly matters, when it comes to things that are nogea ruchnius, mima'al, look at those who have achieved more than you have as inspiration. Asher ba'aretz, and when it comes to gashmius, when it comes to physical things down here in this world, don't look at the person who's able to afford the nicer house and the fancier car and the better vacation and the asher ba'aretz mitachas. Look at those who have less. Look at those who have less and manage to get by with less than we have. So that's Perek Yud Zayin. Perek Yud Ches, we're only going to spend 2 minutes, I guess, but we'll just maybe give a basic overview. As we pointed out before, this is Shiras David. This is the Perek that David HaMelech really, he really expresses what's going on in his heart. And according to some, this is a Perek that he wrote early in life and constantly went back to throughout life. Through all the trials and tribulations, this was his poem. This was the Shiras David. This is where he found comfort. And he starts it with Lamnatzeach le'eved Hashem le'David. Right away, identifying as an Eved Hashem. Now, identifying as an Eved Hashem is not a simple thing to do. I remember in yeshiva once we were singing, Ki ani avdecha, ani avdecha ben amasecha, and it was Purim. And I remember one boy was going around like, it was a Purim, he was a little inebriated, I believe, and he was going around and he grabbed each of us by our shirt, by the lapels, and saying, are you really an Eved? Are you really an Eved Hashem? Sincerely. It's a little frightening, you know. Are you really? The only people in Tanakh that called themselves Eved Hashem were later confirmed by HaKadosh Baruch Hu to accurately, in fact, be Avdei Hashem. Person, it's only the likes of Moshe, Avram, Yaakov, Moshe. Very rarely do we find someone who earns that title of Eved Hashem. So David HaMelech earns the title of an Eved Hashem. Eved is a very important relationship. You know, we think of Eved as such a negative thing. That because slavery, Abraham Lincoln freed the slaves. We don't have slavery. No, but Eved Hashem is an empowering thing. It's the ultimate joy in life to be an Eved Hashem. See, when we talk about HaKadosh Baruch Hu, we talk about HaKadosh Baruch Hu in every bracha we make. Baruch atah Hashem, which is us as an Eved to an Adon. That's why it's a shame of Adon. Elkeinu Melech Ha'olam. So we talk about Hashem as an Adon and as a Melech. The Adon, we're talking as an Eved. As a Melech, when we talk to him as a Melech, it's like a citizen. But who do you have a relationship with? Who has a better who has more of a personal relationship? A citizen to a Melech or an Eved to an Adon? The Adon knows the Eved's name. The Eved knows the Adon. They have a much more closer personal relationship. A melech is all powerful. It's an expression of the power of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. But before the expression of the power of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, we have to realize that we matter to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So Eved Hashem is not it's not an indignity. To the contrary, it's the ultimate compliment to be an Eved Hashem. And that's how David HaMelech is identifying, as he says, Asher Dibra LaHashem as Divrei Hashira Azos B'Yom Yitzil Hashem Oso Mikav Kaloiva V'Miyad Sha'ul. On the day that Hashem saved me from all of my enemies and from Sha'ul, of all of his enemies, Shaul was the trickiest. Shaul was the most difficult for him. Because it's not that he couldn't defeat Shaul. He could have. He had the opportunity to kill Shaul. But how can you kill a tzaddik? How can you do that to Shaul? You know, when Avshalom rebelled against him, that was very tricky also. He didn't want Avshalom to get killed. He wanted to protect Avshalom as his son. He was not interested in killing his son, but he wasn't a tzaddik. Here you have Shaul was a tzaddik. Mishichmo lemailu, mikol ha'am. He was a towering figure spiritually, a spiritual giant. How do you kill a Shaul? He couldn't do it. He cut off the corner of the coat. He did it, but he couldn't kill a Shaul. So that's why Dafka, when he talks about all of his challenges, the challenge of having to deal with Shaul gets its own special mention. Mikav Kalayev Miyad Shaul, and he goes on to describe in great detail. It's worth a read through to chazer over from what we saw in Shmuel Beis, but in great detail, much of his emotion as he goes through all the trials and tribulations of life. Gutevach, everybody, and thank you very much for coming.